From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Jeffrey Gorski, diplomat and lawyer at the U.S. Department of State and author of the critically acclaimed book, Exiles in Sephard, The Jewish Millennium in Spain. The book covers in depth the 1,000-year Jewish history in Spain from about 711 to 1654. During this period, which was marked by Muslim and Christian rule, Sephardic Jews crafted historic works in literature, science, philosophy, and religion. They enjoyed a level of prosperity, particularly during Muslim rule, unparalleled elsewhere in Europe, which was still living in the so-called Dark Ages. Their cultural contributions include important poets, the great philosopher who mostly published in Arabic, Moses Maimonides, and Moses de Leon, author of the Zohar, the core text of the mystical Kabbalah. However, as Jeffrey Gorski relates in his book, Exiles in Sephard, their successes and achievements did not come without great tribulations. After some fundamentalist Islamic tribes disrupted the mostly tolerant reign of Muslim rulers, Jews migrated to predominantly Christian areas of Spain, only to be subjected to mobs of anti-Jewish rioters, especially in the late 14th century. When the Catholic Church began reasserting its influence as part of the so-called Reconquista, Jews were forced to convert to Christianity or flee. But even after Jews converted to Christianity, some of the new Christians, as they were called, were suspected of secretly practicing Judaism. So the Inquisition was created to root out and persecute those converts. Jews who refused to convert fled to and found shelter in the mostly Muslim lands of North Africa and the former Ottoman Empire. So what had been the most populous and prosperous Jewish community in Europe ceased to exist on the Iberian Peninsula by about the mid-17th century. It is estimated that 20% of Jews today are descended from Sephardic Jews. Ironically, governments in both Spain and Portugal have recently passed laws that would give citizenship to Jews who can prove they are of Sephardic descent. A lawyer by training, Mr. Gorski is an expert in immigration law. Previously, he was stationed as a consular officer in Medellin and Bogota, Colombia, as well as Bilbao, Spain. Now he is here with us at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his new book, Exiles in Sephard, The Jewish Millennium in Spain. Well, Jeffrey Gorski, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
But you know, Jeffrey, there are many scholars and authors who've written about this so-called Golden Age of Spain, the Jewish experience therein. What's different about your book?
It really is unique. It's a very underrepresented period. There are a lot of scholarly works about specific periods. Netanyahu, very familiar name because he's the father of the current prime minister, was an expert on the period, and he wrote this huge book called The Origin of the Inquisition in 15th Century Spain, but it was only about that one period. And so there are a lot of technical books, but there's only one other general history, which is Jane Gerber's The Jews of Spain. And because she covers the whole period up to modern times, it was written in 1990, so it's a little out of date. And because she covers that enormous period, she only has 140 pages for 1,000 years of history. I'm really the only other book besides her in print and the only book to focus on the period in Spain. So while you would think this is a well-covered and well-documented period, in fact, for the general reader, they don't have a lot of choice.
And what specifically prompted you to write this? Did your stay in Bilbao have something to do with that?
Oh, yes, very much. I spent 2 years working in Spain. And in Bilbao, I learned the strange position Jews have in Spain because there's so few. They weren't even allowed to reside in Spain until around the 1950s, legally. The ban on Jews, the expulsion in 1492, lasted for centuries. So I was one of fewer than 10 Jews living in the Bilbao metropolitan area, and that's a big city. After I worked in Bilbao, I spent another 2 years as an intelligence analyst at the State Department. They have a Bureau of Intelligence and Research, also working on Spanish issues. So I spent 4 years on the subject, and that's what got me interested.
Well, Jeffrey Gorski, a central question that you yourself pose and answer in the book, I'd like you to do for us here today. Why were Spanish Jews, in your view, granted so much freedom and access to power compared to their brethren, for example, in England or France or elsewhere in Europe?
the metaphor that I use is that there was a marriage of convenience, that there were specific practical considerations that led the rulers first of Muslim Spain and then Christian Spain to give these privileges to the Jews in exchange for very practical advantages they got from the Jews. And so it was like a contracted marriage. And that gave them a sense of security that was unmatched anywhere else in Europe. But at the same time, it wasn't true tolerance because they still continued to live in separate communities. They had their separate laws and their separate rulers, and the frictions between the religions remained. I mean, there were still a lot of inherent tensions between both Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Christianity and Judaism. And those tensions could bubble up in times of unrest and uncertainty. So when the king was unable to provide protection because of periods of insecurity and instability, that marriage would dissolve, and it could lead to periods of great violence. And in the end, it led to the end of Jewish life, first in Muslim Spain, and then centuries later in Christian Spain.
So, Jeffrey, are you contesting what some call convivencia, this term that refers to the so-called golden age, particularly under Muslim rule, where Jews were not equal necessarily, but they certainly were tolerated and played an important role? Well, you're saying no, it's not so much that way.
Well, I think convivencia is a very interesting and useful idea, and it's certainly become very popular, but it's a very new idea. The traditional Spanish idea of their history focuses on what's called the Reconquest or the Reconquista. And under this idea, the traditional Spanish view, Spain is a nation of pure, devout Christians who fought against the Muslim and the Jewish influences to purify their country. So you have these two inherently contradictory ideas of Spanish history, and I tried to find a way in between. They both reflect real elements in Spain, but I think the metaphor of marriage of convenience is probably the more accurate, and there are other scholars, I think, have taken similar points of view.
We'll talk more about convivencia, marriage of convenience, in just a moment. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA. Our special guest is Jeffrey Gorski. He's a U.S. diplomat and author of the recently published book, Exiles in Sefarad, The Jewish Millennium in Spain. Well, Jeffrey, we were talking about the concept of convivencia, or as you prefer to call it, this marriage of convenience, when Jews were in Spain and lived among Muslim rulers, and then after that, Christian rulers. But let me ask you something more specific, because under Muslim majority rule, there was certainly relatively harmonious coexistence among Muslims, Christians, and Jews, particularly under
Abdullah Rahman III.
Exactly. Abd Rahman for several hundred years. Notwithstanding the fact that after Reconquista, when the Christians took over, there was certainly a period where there was some amount of tolerance. The thing is that with the Muslims, there wasn't really a theological dispute, one could argue, since both Muslims and Jews are strict monotheists. Whereas with the Christians who subscribe to the Trinity, one could say that they had another bone of contention, one might argue, with Jews. Would you agree with that?
I think the tensions are similar for both faiths, because the problem both Islam and Christianity had is because they embraced the traditions of Judaism, they couldn't condemn the Jews as a bad religion because they had all the tenets within their faith. In order to distinguish themselves, they had to show that only they were the proper holders and bearers of that tradition. And one way to do that was to denigrate the Jews. And Islam had the same issue with Christianity because they also embraced the tenets of Christianity. So they had to denigrate Christians and Jews in order to show that only they properly understood that tradition and were the appropriate holders of that tradition.
Except I would just take issue because under Muslim rule, there wasn't so much persecution based on religion, whereas under the Christians, it was all about the Jews not accepting the Trinity and that they had to convert. Even Muslims would have had to convert and probably did have to convert after 1492. It was very, very severe, this type of discrimination, which one does not really see when Muslims were running Al-Andalus.
There were mass conversions in the Muslim period, And Maimonides wrote a book called A Consolation to Yemen about Yemenites who were forced to convert under the Muslim rule in that country. And that was a huge Jewish population. The issue was among Judaism, was that were you allowed to embrace Islam on the surface if you stuck to Judaism within your heart, if you were forced to convert? So he had to address that issue in the context of Islam too. So it happened under Islam, and it was believed that Maimonides himself, some people think, may have been forced to convert in northern Morocco. So there were fundamentalist tribes who were repressing Jews. I mean, it happened off and on. There was periods of tolerance and periods of intolerance among both the faiths. But what made Christianity sometimes more anti-Jewish was the idea of Jews as the Christ killer. And that made Jews more of an enemy, and it allowed for a visceral hatred among some believing Christians who embraced that idea that probably was hard to find among Islam, because you didn't have that similar, really visceral basis for hatred.
Now, you also talked about that stable rulers were very good for Jews, that they both flourished under strong rulers, under Muslim rule as well as Christian. Talk about how important that was.
It started among the Muslim invasion. And when the Muslims invaded, it was a small Arab minority who was ruling a very large province with a majority Christian population. And the Jews at that point had been horribly persecuted under the predecessors, the people called the Visigoths, who were Germanic people from the Baltic area who were among a lot of these German tribes who picked up the leavings of the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire expired, they got Spain. And they embraced, among alternative rulers, some of them embraced the worst anti-Jewish measures in European history up to the Holocaust. I mean, measures that were literally genocidal. They made it a capital offense to practice Judaism, some of the kings. Now, they were very weak rulers, and they weren't able to effectively implement this. And the Jews were probably able to get shelter among the powerful barons in that country. There's not that much known about the Visigoth period. So there was that tradition.
I think that's very important that you bring up the Visigoths, because, of course, they really were a major contrast. So when the Arabs came, the Muslims, there was like a liberation for the Jews.
Exactly.
So we're talking about in the 700s.
And the invasion was 710, and so the Jews were trusted allies because they had no reason to trust the Christians who had persecuted them, and they could provide assistance to a minority Arab population in their rule over this majority Christian population, which sometimes were docile, but sometimes could flare up and rebel against the Arab minority. So the Jews were trusted allies, and they were given more power and more ability to prosper than they might have been given other places in Islam.
And with respect to this concept that stable, strong rulers were better for Jews, whether under Muslim rule or Christians, is important because, as you alluded to earlier, weak or fractious leadership, and particularly the internal tensions that beset the latter part of Muslim rule, really didn't favor the Jews. They were, as you said, notwithstanding earlier tolerance and, in fact, having served the caliphate in very important positions. Later on, some of the fundamentalist tribes from North Africa actually upset the stability of the rule.
Exactly. What happened in Muslim Spain, aside from the pressure from the north, from the Christians moving in, it fell apart under its own inherent contradictions, because you had a very small minority Arab rulers, you had a large Muslim Berber population from North Africa, you had the large Christian population, and you had this big country with mountains and rivers that was difficult to navigate by those, you know, by the transportation of the time. So it made it a very difficult area to rule, and it finally fell apart. It fell into civil war, and it broke into these very small city-states called taifas or party states. And initially, that did open up opportunities for the Jews that weren't there before, because without the Arab aristocracy controlling all the power, little pockets of power could develop, which opened in areas for the Jews, in particular in the new city of Granada, which was started by these Berbers. The Berbers were, I wouldn't say primitive, but they were soldiers. They didn't know a lot about administration. Their idea of running a country was to tax it to death. And one very sophisticated man named Samuel Nagrela, who's known as the first great Hebrew poet, he became the Grand Vizier and the effective ruler of the city-state of Granada, which included ruling the army. He became the first Jewish military leader since the fall of Israel. And this is at a time when there were continuously warring between these little states for little pockets of territory. So every year he would march out at the heads of his army. There's some controversy about how much he was involved with military might and military warfare, but did have at least some involvement, and he wrote a poetry about it. He wrote the first, maybe the only battle poetry in Hebrew until modern times. But he went too far, because he eventually, when he died, he left the title Grand Vizier to his son, Joseph, who started a palace, which may be the foundation for the most famous building in Spain, the Alhambra. But that was seen as an affront to many of the Muslims, and they wrote violent anti-Jewish poetry against him. It roused up mob violence, and it ended up with a massacre in 1066 of the Jewish population in Granada, which was about a third of the population in the city. It was called the City of Jews at the time, which was the worst period of Muslim violence in Spain against the Jews. And then, as you mentioned, fundamentalist tribes were able then to take advantage of the weakness of the Muslim states. They came in from North Africa, and they were intolerant fundamentalists who drove the Jews out. And that's why Maimonides, who was born in Cordoba, ended up having to flee Spain with his family at the age of about 7.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jeffrey Gorski. He's a diplomat and lawyer at the U.S. Department of State and author of the recently published book, Exiles in Sephard, The Jewish Millennium in Spain. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for a free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Ana Riana from Riyadh. If you want to hear your name on the show, send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Jeffrey Gorski. We were talking about the Jews in Spain, 1,000 years under predominantly Muslim and then Christian rule, at which point they had to leave. But let's talk about how Jews flourished, particularly under Muslim rule. We were just talking a bit ago about Maimonides. Talk about some of the texts and the poems and the types of things that the Jews did, roles they played.
Sure. Well, poetry is very interesting because Islam has something of a negative view towards times, towards poetry and music. But there was a longer tradition in the Arab culture for court music and poetry. And that became very important in Muslim Spain, and in fact may have influenced Western development of music and poetry through the troubadours of Provence. And they may have been influenced by that. So if you know the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, you know, they talk about the Saki, which was the serving boy who would serve wine. They would sit in their gardens, and sacks of wine at night would go around the gardens, and they would recite poetry. And the poetry was very formalistic. It was based on certain formal tropes. And the Jews emulated this, and they took Hebrew, which at that point was solely a religious language, and it was used for other legalistic forms, but they started writing Hebrew poetry. It was the first secular Hebrew poetry, and it was very important poetry. I mean, they're great poets. I mentioned Negrella, but also probably the greatest of all was a man named Judah Halevi, and he wrote one of his best-known poems, and I almost use that for the title of my book. It goes, "My heart is in the east, but I am here on the edge of the west." And there was another poet, very interesting man named Salomon ibn Gabarel, who was what's called a Neoplatonist, and he believed that the soul was trapped on earth and longed to flee and go back. It was almost a Hindu concept of the soul. It became important among mystical Christians later on, and he wrote a book which was translated into Latin as Fons Vitae, or the Fountain of Life, and that became one of the most important sources of Neoplatonism. And they didn't know that he wrote it. It was believed to have been written by a Muslim or a Christian, and it wasn't until, I think, the 18th century they discovered that he was the actual author, and it was originally written, I think, in Hebrew.
And, of course, the Muslims brought Europe out of the Dark Ages through their rule of Spain. There was the translation of classical texts, and Jews played an important role in that as well.
It was a very important time for Jews to live in Muslim Spain because Islam, at that point, was a leading civilization in the West. Not only its sciences, they developed the astrolabe, which was the essential role for navigation. They made major advances in mathematics, so that in English, half the words we have for math are from Arabic. Algebra, algorithm. They took the zero from India and they used that, and the Jews participated in all of that and in medicine. And medicine became a very important practice for the Jews, partially because there was a belief at the time among those Jews in Spain that there was a stigma towards making a living off teaching religion, that religion should not be exploited for material gain. So the greatest religious thinkers of the time, and Maimonides is one of them, had to find other ways to make a living. They couldn't make a living as rabbis because that was seen as unfairly exploiting their religious knowledge. And physician, since it was an intellectual profession, was one that they found very comfortable to work with. And Maimonides ended up writing treatises about medicine that eventually became important in the West in their development of medicine, including a book about hemorrhoids. He wrote another book about sexual dysfunction.
Who would have thought? Well, talk about Muslims under Christian rule. Once Granada fell in 1492, Reconquista, you have Ferdinand and Isabella, the Inquisition was imposed. What happened to Muslims? Did they also have to convert or leave, or how were they treated differently, or the same?
First of all, there were centuries after the Reconquest, because the Reconquest started around the 13th century, and that's when the major efforts were made that conquered most of the South. And then the South became like a pioneering land because many of the Muslims had fled, so much of it was empty. And one reason the Jews became resurgent in the South, the Jews, when the fundamentalist Berbers came in, fled to the Christian lands, and they found the same marriage of convenience applied in that their administrative skills, their cultural sophistication, and the capital, the wealth that they developed through trading in the Muslim lands, were very welcome in these new sort of raw frontier lands that were just conquered by these Christian knights in a feudal system. So they were welcomed into the court just as they had been under the Muslim lands. Many of the Muslims who remained were workers and peasants, but they did find a space. You know, there was this kind of convivencia going on among all three faiths at the same time that they were warring against Islam. The Reconquista was far from an unrelenting battle. And in fact, the most famous battler for Christianity in the Reconquista, El Cid, and there's a movie about El Cid, everybody knows El Cid, he ended up fighting as a ruler of the Muslim armies against the Christian forces. Christians made a lot of money towards the end and tributes from the Muslim lands, which were wealthy because they had a lot of agricultural knowledge through irrigation and through crops that weren't available otherwise in the West. So there was a lot of mix, and the idea of convivencia did measure in.
But only to a certain point, because Inquisition then was instituted.
Well, the Inquisition was only directed. The key event for the Jews in Spain wasn't 1492 so much as 1391. Because 1390, there were more Jews in Spain than all the rest of Europe combined. And they had reached levels of wealth and power and cultural sophistication that was unheard of anywhere else in the West. 1391, a rogue priest, without the support of either the church or the state, the church had continuously tried to keep him to refrain from making anti-Jewish measures. They were going to excommunicate him. The state had ordered him to stand down repeatedly. He constantly resisted stopping his anti-Jewish measures, until in 1391, the Archbishop of Seville, who was going to excommunicate him, died. The marriage of convenience broke down, and Fernand Martinez, who was this rogue priest, was able to incite mobs first through all the Castilian cities and then through the neighboring Kingdom of Aragon with the slogan, "Convert or Die." And these mobs rose out against the wishes of the state and against the wishes of the church. And that's what resulted in the mass conversions of a third to a half of the Jewish population. After that, the church and the state took advantage of that and started to apply other repressive measures that led to some further conversions. But when power was restored around 1412, the Jews were able to live in relative security then. But what happened was the rise of a new class called the conversos. And they had incredible success initially. They became the administrative leaders of the court. They became powerful in the church. The leading cleric of the 15th century was a man named Torquemada, the uncle of the man who would later become part of the Inquisition, Cardinal Torquemada, and he became the defender of the Roman Catholic faith in the Vatican.
So he was originally a Jew who converted to Christianity.
That's what it's generally believed, that he was a converso, that he had converted to Christianity, at least, or one of his parents had. And the reason why they do it is because he became a defender of the conversos when they started to be attacked in mid-century, and he was outed by another prominent converso who, in order to show how the conversos were important to Spanish culture, wrote a book talking about all the great conversos of the time.
Indeed. Well, just the fact that Jews were forced to convert, notwithstanding once they converted they had good positions, is really troubling. And you say in the book also that by 1492, when the edict for the Inquisition, the edict for the expulsion of the Jews came out by Ferdinand and Isabella, that there was relative stability, which contradicts your thesis that strong leadership is good for the Jews. But right at the time that leadership was strongest, the Inquisition began.
Exactly. And the reason for that is because there was no longer a need for the marriage of convenience. And that was because the conversos were so numerous that they were able to substitute for the Jews. Fernando and Isabella didn't need the Jews anymore because they had the conversos who did everything they did. And they were Christians and they were under their control and power because the Inquisition, which wasn't directed against the Jews, with a few minor exceptions, the reason why they started the Inquisition in 1481 was to determine whether the conversos were really Christians or were they secretly practicing Judaism.
Exactly, which is what I said in the introduction.
Sure.
And here's what I find most troubling, the fact that after having converted to Christianity, there was still this doubt. It seemed like no matter how Christian the Jews became, even one that was the ancestor of the man who created the Inquisition, this was still not good enough.
In my book, I think a lot of that had to do with very specific political events that were taking place in Castile in the century, where you had two generations of unstable kings. And because the conversos were very closely aligned with the kings, they became convenient scapegoats for the failings of the kings and the conflicts that were going on between the kings and the aristocrats. It was a period of near civil war. And eventually, towards a later period, that civil war developed between the new and old Christians, which started fighting actual battles. There was a massacre of new Christians in Cordoba later in that century. So my feeling was, what's interesting about Fernando and Isabel, I quote a famous nursery rhyme from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow about the little girl with a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. When they were good, they were very, very good. And when they were bad, they were horrid. They were not simple towards the Jews or the conversos. They were initially very, very much in favor of the Jews and the conversos. Some of the closest advisors to Isabel and Fernando in their court were Jews. And that was unusual because the conversos had taken on that role and the Jews had pretty much disappeared from the court. But a man named Abrahan Senor, who was a town treasurer, and he was a very early supporter and financer of Isabel, he may have helped pay for her wedding. And she kept him in the court until the expulsion when she convinced him to convert to Christianity. And another very important man named Isaac Abravanel, who was the greatest Jew of his time in that period, also was very close to the court and very close to the king and queen. But the Inquisition, once it was formed, kind of took over its own momentum. It was led by very fanatic Dominicans who embraced an older Inquisition structure and tradition that came from other periods where they were trying to get rid of heresy, particularly the Albigensian heresy or the Cathars. And they led it with extreme violence. First in Seville, they burnt many of the major conversos to death at the stake. And they, through torture and other areas of compulsion, they started to come up with reams of evidence showing that they were, in fact, heretics. They were practicing Jews. And they did that partially because they had a very wide definition of what Judaism was. A lot of what they showed were practices and habits and traditions that might not be considered heresy today, like not eating pork. That was heresy under their rules. So they came up with that, and eventually they started lobbying to get rid of the Jews with the idea that the Jews were undermining the faith of the conversos, that as long as there was a stable Jewish community in Spain, the conversos would never adhere to Christianity because they would always have their friends and relatives to go to. And the model of expulsion at that time was common in Europe, because England had expelled their Jews and France had expelled their Jews. So Spain wasn't seen as doing anything aberrant. They were seen as just taking on a policy that was standard in Western Europe at the time.
Fast forward to today as we close. Jeffrey Gorski, now we're looking at Spain and Portugal. Both governments are declaring that those of Sephardic descent could potentially return, maybe even acquire Portuguese or Spanish citizenship. What do you make of these recently declared policies?
This is not really a new movement. It started in the 1920s. There was a movement of nationalism that argued that for nationalist purposes, they should embrace the Sephardic diaspora in order to extend Spanish influence. And that would expand Spanish influence over the world. And they gave nationality to Jews of Spanish origin in the 1920s, but it was a nationality without the right to reside in Spain because it was still illegal for Jews to actually live in Spain.
The book is Exiles in Sephardi, The Jewish Millennium in Spain. The author, Jeffrey Gorski, he's a diplomat and lawyer at the U.S. Department of State. Jeffrey, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much, Carol.
Sharing your insights, and congratulations once again on your terrific book. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.